It is Monday, February 27th, 2023. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Naomi Orsic, professor of history of science at Harvard University, author of The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market, co-authored with Eric Conway. Also on the program today, huge news. Jeb Bush endorses Ron DeSantis.
It's the kiss of death from The Godfather.
Stay tuned to this space. Meanwhile, the Department of Energy issues a low confidence conclusion that COVID was leaked from a Wuhan lab. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's student debt relief plan in front of the Supreme Court tomorrow. Massive protests in Mexico over changes or proposed changes to their election bureau. Newspapers drop Dilbert cartoon after its creator publicly announces he's a racist. Report: Trump White House demanded ABC censor Jimmy Kimmel. Another new report: child labor increasing in the wake of the pandemic in this country. UK and EU agree to a Northern Ireland trade deal. Fox News censoring its media reporter over the $1.6 billion Dominion lawsuit. Alyssa Slotkin announces her Michigan Senate run. Elon Musk lays off more at Twitter and then announces that the media is racist against white people.
Ah, he's in solidarity with Dilbert.
Yep. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. It's the beginning of the week. Welcome back to me.
Welcome back, Sam.
Emma Vigeland, of course,
yes.
My co-host, did an excellent job in my absence.
Did you watch?
No, but yeah. I heard from a lot of people. Matt, you gotta get Emma on screen. Bradley's out of town right now, so
he'll be back tomorrow. But
no,
I'm
not gonna watch.
Yesterday.
It's my vacation, as it were.
Right. No, I know. I just wanted to know if this was coming from you know.
Well, no. More importantly, it's coming from viewers and
viewers
listeners
like you.
Exactly.
Thank
viewers
you.
And listeners like you folks out there. I spent a big part of the week helping one of my parents into a nursing home, which was not the funnest of things to do, but she's in, you know, she seems to be, to the extent that we can sort of glean these things, she seems to be adjusting nicely. And my sisters have been doing the yeoman's work on that. And one thing, though, that was interesting, and, you know, we got a story in the stack of all these maternity wards closing down in rural hospitals around the country. And one of the things, too, we should say that Bernie Sanders had proposed in the Build Back Better bill was to finally address the issue of nursing homes. Two-thirds of nursing home patients are there on Medicaid because it's incredibly costly. But to qualify for Medicaid to pay for a nursing home, you need to, depending on the state that you're living in, essentially have almost no assets. You can go down to $2,000 in terms of assets. So that's just an incredible, I mean, it's a very difficult sort of like way to navigate, right? Because
yeah.
If you have $5,000 worth of assets, you know, you want to make sure that you can get into a home. What also I've learned through this process is we were in there fixing up her room so that it would, you know, seem like seem like, you know, be like reminiscent home, of, yeah. Of her former apartment. And, there was a handyman there, and it was, cause they're a little worried about, like, you know, mounting a TV, for instance, they want, you know, the liability issues or whatnot.
Right.
And, he had come back after 10 years, to work at this home. And he said, the thing that he liked about it is the staffing's good because it's a nonprofit. And we have had many, many, many healthcare worker strikes that we've reported on and have happened in this country over the past couple of years. And invariably, it is more often than not, much more often than not, for-profit hospitals or health groups or whatnot. And this is where they cut. They cut on staffing. And so, you know, in this instance, a not-for-profit, instead of shareholders getting a big chunk of change, that money goes towards making sure it's properly staffed. And so you have people who've worked at this facility for, you know, 15, 20, 25 years. People are coming back to work at it because it's properly staffed. And you know, people who work in a healthcare facility, they want to help people.
That matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and they, it's difficult to work at a place where, you know, it is understaffed, but, let's, move forward. We got a couple of ads in a bit. We will get to that, but let's get on to the big news. And I'm glad, you know, a lot of times when I go out on vacation, I miss the big news.
Right.
But I came back in time for the big news today. And that is, this video, which was released, when was it? This morning,
over the weekend?
Or over
yesterday,
the
I think.
Yeah,
I think
Saturday.
Yeah.
I mean, this is exciting Saturday. Stuff. A lot of people are talking about this. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if people remember Jeb Bush, but here is Jeb Bush.
Jeb.
I think it's pretty remarkable.
And he hasn't declared yet. Many in the Republican Party hope he soon will. Is this Ron DeSantis' opportunity to run for higher office?
I think it is. He's been a really effective governor. He's young. I think we're on the verge of a generational change in our politics. I kind of hope so. I think it's time for a more forward-leaning, future-oriented conversation in our politics as well.
Which has made him, should he choose to run for president, a serious contender in Republican politics.
And who better to do it than someone who's been outside of Washington, who's governed effectively, who I think has shown that Florida could be a model for the future of our country.
So was that Jeb Bush's endorsement, or is it a little tepid?
It was a little weird. I mean, I guess that was on Kilmeade's show, right? But I mean, DeSantis hasn't announced that he's running. This is them. They're freaking out right now. They are freaking out that DeSantis, who's the loser run, he's doing the crime tour of Chicago and Philly and New York and speaking to police unions. Trump's out on the ground in East Palestine giving out free McDonald's and water to the people there. I mean, the primary already kind of feels over, but I know it's not. But they're panicked, right? They're Eric Levitz had a great piece in New York Magazine speaking about how desperately the Republican Party is trying to brand DeSantis as like the reasonable moderate, someone that Wall Street Journal readers can get behind because he went to an Ivy League school. But that's not going to square with the general population in the general election, when all he can talk about is trans kids and banning books and critical race theory. No one, that's alienating to people.
The real problem that he has, and I think there was a poll that came out from Fox News that I think had Trump up 43 to like 28. Against DeSantis.
We showed one from Morning Consult where it's 50 to 30.
Yeah. There is a huge gulf here. Now, it's conceivable that if all of the supporters for all the other candidates rally around DeSantis, if DeSantis turns out to be really dynamic and whatnot, maybe there's a slight chance it'll be competitive. But the problem that DeSantis has, as you just alluded to, is that to beat Trump, he's going to have to get even more anti-trans, more anti-book, more anti-black, more anti-history than he is now, which is incredible how, you know, much of a freak show he is. And there's no way you can hide that from the American public. And so it is going to be a huge turnoff as he chases Trump. Here's Donald Trump on Truth Social, apparently still waiting for whatever the non-compete clause that he signed for his own thing. Fox News is promoting Ron DeSantis so much, so hard, and so much that there's not much time left for real news. Reminds me of 2016 when they were pushing Jeb.
Well,
the new Fox poll, which have always been purposely terrible for me, has Trump in all capitals crushing DeSanctimonious. He's using two different versions of the DeSanctus.
I don't get DeSanctus, yeah. But I mean, I guess he's getting
Latin. It's Latin for holy because it's holier than thou. How many times do I have to explain it?
But they barely show it. Instead, they go with losers like Karl Rove, Paul Ryan, and now even Jesper. That's
what?
Esper, right? That's
Yeah.
Who?
He's a yes man.
Yes.
Got it.
Although he said no to me. He can't even get that right. Who have been wrong about everything. Isn't there a big, beautiful network which wants to do well and make a fortune besides fake news?
So what's Ron DeSantis? We're going like Sanctus, he's above it all? We're going Latin?
I don't know.
He's holier than thou.
I don't know.
Veni, vidi, vici, Ron. I'm going to conquer you.
This is going to nice. This is going to be an interesting primary. I don't say fun, although I think it's going to be fun, but I don't say fun
because
it's
uncouth to say it's fun.
It's not couth to say it's going to be fun.
We're going to have fun.
It could lead to a disaster.
War with China.
I mean God knows, yeah. Frankly. But
or invading Mexico like his son's been talking about.
But this is the fun part. I mean, like, this is the time where we can party as the flames kind of before they engulf us, right?
Right. I guess that's true. And so, you know, when you know the flames are coming, it's not necessarily quite as fun.
Well, especially when you've done it already.
That's called cognitive dissonance.
2016. I still remember it. I'm not that old. But in a moment, we're going to be talking to Naomi Oreskes. She's a professor of history of science at Harvard. She's written a book. Well, she was the one who, she and Eric Conway wrote Merchant of Doubt about tobacco.
Oh, right.
And which was a huge book. And then I think became a documentary as well. Now they're dealing with just the entire free market, the big myth, how American business taught us to loathe government and love the free market. You're going to want to stick around for that. Message today from one of our favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake CBDA, introducing its newest topical product. I have loved their existing salve, but they have, it's for muscles, but I used it for eczema as well. They now have an extra strength muscle rub and all of their CBDA, topicals. Doesn't matter whether it's like the, lotion like this or their new salve, or their existing salve or their new muscle rub are 25% off. If you use the coupon code extra at checkout. Their new extra strength muscle rub is made with quality ingredients like beeswax, shea butter, arnica, full spectrum CBDA oil, menthol and camphor oil as well. You're going to recognize the scent and the cooling feeling and will help with your minor soreness and deep aches and includes lidocaine, which is a topical anesthetic. Folks at Sunset Lake CBDA, super excited to release this. If you like their salve, you're going to love this new rub. It has three times as much CBDA as their hemp salve. Their extra strength muscle rub is made with quality ingredients, like I say. I love that salve. I'm excited to try this. And Emma took a big whiff of it, and she said...
It smells good.
She said, I am okay doing this. Because it's actually true. Like, as long as it's not floral,
right?
I don't have a bad reaction to it. And it's also great. You know what I like doing is rubbing that stuff when I got a cold or stuffed up.
We were saying I could use that right now.
Sunset Lake, a great company. They don't use any pesticides or herbicides in the growing of their sebede. Also, it's all outside, which is huge, both from an environmental standpoint in that it saves, you know, the electrical grid. Also, I've been told outside hemp is the best, but they also, they use integrated pest management. They don't use any herbicides or pesticides. Like I said, all of their stuff is third-party tested. They have great business practices. They've just actually, they donated $1,000 to, who was it? To the, strike fund. $1,000 to the Amalgamated Transit Union, a local 689 down in DC. We reported on that, on those strikes down there. They're just a great company. SunsetLakeSebede.com. Check it out. Also, if you use Left is Best, you're going to get that, every day, 20% off. But if you go and use Extra right now, you will save an extra 5% on their salves. Salves?
Salve.
Salve.
Salve, I think.
Another sponsor today, ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter has been a company that we've been that has been advertising with us for years. And in fact, after a couple of years, I needed to hire somebody. And I use ZipRecruiter, and that's the way we found old Brendan, who still actually works from the show, but remotely now. And then that's how we got Bradley via Brendan. ZipRecruiter was huge. Job seekers want more these days from things like remote working conditions, easier application process. And the real question for you as a hirer, how do you break through the clutter, attract the most qualified candidates for your business? Well, the answer is, like I said, ZipRecruiter. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. There are a bunch of ways that ZipRecruiter helps you find the right candidates. ZipRecruiter's technology sends you great candidates for your job. You can send a personal invite to your top choices. Makes an impact. They are more likely to apply. ZipRecruiter also makes it easy for candidates to apply to your job once they decide to. In fact, they can apply with one click. ZipRecruiter offers attention-grabbing labels like urgent, training provided, remote, and more that's going to catch the eye of a quality candidate. Get your job noticed by the best and brightest candidates with ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I am one of those 4. Go see for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter, and you can try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. And also, as you know, I am very uptight about getting my ID stolen just because it's a psychological. Well, I mean, it's a huge pain and everybody's terrified of it. But I'm very neurotic about these things. And I will not click on any link. I've got it all locked up in terms of phishing. But it happens, folks. There are all sorts of data leaks. Happened with Twitter. Happened with Seamless. I got busted on Seamless.
Oh my gosh. Yep.
That was a huge pain, actually. Man. I had to cancel that credit card and do all that stuff. But there is a specific app that will keep you safe in your online persona, and that is Aura. They are sponsoring today's program. It's an easy-to-use app. It includes everything you need to stay safe online. Aura protects you from scammers and hackers. They scan the dark web, see if anybody's trading your emails or your passwords or any combination or your social security numbers. And if it finds anything, it alerts you fast. They also help you fight back against those annoying websites that make your personal information public by automatically requesting removal of your info. This helps reduce robocalls and junk mail, and it helps with operational security, as it were, or it gives you near real-time alerts if anybody's trying to open up an account in your name, like a credit card or a loan. I got one of those when I opened up a bank account for Mila, which she apparently does not use to save any money. Their VPN allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. They can protect your devices from viruses, malware, spyware, all that stuff. Keep the bad guys out. They even can help you control what your kids do on their devices. Set screen time limits. Set focus time limits. Restrict apps, et cetera, et cetera. They have a password manager that allows you to access your online passwords securely and conveniently. And maybe you have an app that does one of these things. Bottom line is this one app does all like seven of those functions. Let Aura do the hard work of keeping you safe up online. If you sign up right now, Aura is going to give you a 2-week free trial with my link. When you put your email in there, you're going to see how much of your information is or is not compromised. And it'll scare you, but at least you'll know. Go to aura.com/majority. Start your free trial. It's going to be linked in the YouTube and podcast descriptions as all of our ads are. Check it out. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're going to be talking about the big myth, how American business taught us to loathe government and love the free market. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. I want to welcome to the show Naomi Oreskes. She is a professor of history of science at Harvard University, author of The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market, which she co-authored with Eric Conway. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I should say, I mentioned this a little bit earlier in the introduction of the show, but you also co-authored with Eric Conway a really important a book called Merchants of Doubt, which ultimately became a documentary and outlined essentially how, certainly around tobacco, but more broadly speaking, the cadre of scientists who were willing to sort of, I guess, seed doubt, as it were, about scientific things that undermined science for a long time. And this book that you've written now, I think is just, it is so important. And it has been really a theme to many respects that I've been talking about for 18 years since I've been doing this this stuff. Market fundamentalists. And, you know, actually, what is interesting is that I had written a book that was not nearly as good as yours years and years ago that was supposed to be comedic. But I remember it was Gertrude Himmelfarb, who was Bill Kristol's mom, if I'm not mistaken, who was big into science denial as a way to attack objective, objectivity in facts and government. And so there was a connection there. Just talk about for a moment, because and then we'll go into the sort of the details of the book, but that connection between the merchants of doubt and market fundamentalism.
Thank you. So in Merchants of Doubt, one of the questions that Eric Conway and I were trying to answer is, why would intelligent people reject hard-won, well-established scientific evidence, whether it's about climate change or the harms of tobacco use? And the answer we discovered, based on extensive review of documents, including their own letters, their own publication, was market fundamentalism, that they believed strongly in a kind of cosmic conflict between communism and capitalism, and they feared that any compromise to free market capitalism, even a modest one like restricting smoking on airplanes, for example, would put us on a slippery slope to socialism, communism, and ultimately Soviet-style totalitarianism. And so they felt that it was very important for them to push back against the argument for government regulation. And one way they did that was by casting doubt on the scientific information.
That's a so there's, you know, it's obviously they're getting paid, but it's also there's at least enough of a, like a, an ideological tentpole that they can convince themselves they're doing right. Let's talk about the concept of market fundamentalism. What do you mean when you call something market fundamentalism?
I think there are two important components of market fundamentalism. The first is the idea of the free market. So we call this a myth because it's not supported by good scientific or historical evidence. And part of the myth is simply the notion of the free market, the idea that there could even be such a thing as markets that exist apart from the rest of society. In reality, markets are human institutions. They go back to ancient Greece and Rome and Assyria. And there have always been rules and regulations for how markets operate, just as all human institutions, whether it's universities or radio and television or marriage. We have rules and regulations about marriage, and we have rules and regulations about markets. But the market fundamentalists deny this. They construct the free market as something that exists outside of society, culture, and governance, and that has a kind of wisdom that's almost godlike, so that if we simply trust the market, have faith in the market, everything will go fine. And then the second part of it is the role of government. So these are sort of two sides of the same coin. The market fundamentalists are also anti-government. They construct a story that government intervention or government encroachment, that's a word they like to use a lot, undermines the wisdom of the marketplace, therefore is a bad thing, and therefore government regulation, even to address a crisis like the climate crisis or an obvious ill like child labor, they would argue is putting us on the wrong path. It's putting us on what they call the road to serfdom.
Let's, before we get into Hayek and Montpellerin and that whole crew, I've had so many debates with libertarians about that question of a free market, but what is their argument? Like, you know, like, I mean, we could talk about there being a market in ancient Greece or whatnot, but just in that sentence itself, we have to acknowledge that there is some type of structure to society that it, like we don't talk about a free market existing in a place with no name because there has to be a place that has been sort of like, there has to be a society before that happens. But what is their argument that it exists sort of like pre-societally?
Well, I'm not sure they exactly have an argument. I would say that, as you pointed out, market fundamentalism is tied to libertarianism. And libertarianism is based on a radically individualistic notion of human activities, behavior. And so it privileges the individual, and it really glorifies the individual to such an extreme extent that if the government proposes or if reformers propose to regulate something, let's say smoking, these folks will say, no, it's up to me to decide whether or not I smoke. It's not up to the government. And I don't want the government telling me whether or not I can smoke because that leads to tyranny. Now, up to a point, that argument is legitimate, right? I don't want the government telling me how to live my life either, except when I do hurts other people. And the problem is that, and Hayek von Hayek himself said this, everything we do affects the people around us. There are very few things we do that only affect ourselves. And many of the issues that have come to the fore in my work, whether in Merchants of Doubt or in this new book, The Big Myth, are about activities that people do that hurt other people, whether it's smoking cigarettes, dumping carbon pollution in the atmosphere, employing children to work in factories. These are all things that aren't just a matter of what I want to do personally. They're also things that dramatically affect everyone around me.
How American is this, uniquely so? I mean, is it, and how new would you say is like the church of market fundamentalism?
Well, in the book, we tell that story. And we argue that it's not uniquely American. In fact, the key ideas really come from Europe. They're founded in Europe, mostly in Vienna, in the Austrian School of Economics, and then, as Sam just referred to, by something called the Mont Pelerin Society, which was founded in Switzerland. So the key ideas actually come from Europe. But they take on a certain resonance here in the United States, we argue, for two reasons. One is because the radical individualism at the root of this ideology resonates with key aspects of American culture. So the United States is a more radically individualistic place than many other places in the world. And for better or worse, many Americans really do strongly feel, you know, feel strongly about American individualism, that that's a good thing. So market fundamentalism builds on that American commitment to individualism. And like all good propaganda, it has a kernel of truth, because as I just suggested, up to a point, individualism is a good thing, but like many good things, it can be taken too far. The second part of the story, and this is again what we document in the book, is the way in which a group of business executives cultivated these European schools of thought, brought the key thinkers to the United States, paid for them, and worked behind closed doors to get them hired at key universities in the United States, and then consciously and deliberately promoted their work in ways that they thought would resonate with American people and in American culture.
I want to get into that, because this is it's so important. I think this book is so important insofar as like it really outlines that this is a project. This has been a project. It is not this. There's nothing organic per se about this. But with that said, the individualism thing also feels like the individual thing feels like just one element of what it is that Hayek was trying to sort of like promote that just stuck because it there was a tradition of this in the United States. Like, for instance, like it is so post hoc, it seems to me, in terms of justifying no government intrusion, because you can't say it's my individual choice to smoke a cigarette, because cigarettes would not exist without sort of the structure of society. Like, this is like, you can't say it is for me to do what I want with my property, because property is a legal definition that needs a society to determine that. I mean, it's nonsensical on some level to start with an individual relying on a social construct. But they sort of skip that part always. And it's interesting the way they do that. But let's go back to the really nascent stuff in this country, because there was a, even prior to Hayek in The Road to Serfdom, prior to Mont Pelerin, there was in this country a demonization of government in service of business interests. But let's right. talk about that. I guess we're going back to like National Electric Light Association.
Right, or even a little further. So the book begins in the early 20th century with debates over child labor and workmen's compensation. And what we point out, something that many Americans have forgotten or perhaps never knew, is how incredibly dangerous and brutal American capitalism was in the 20th century. So hundreds of thousands of children worked in mines, factories, and mills across this country, some as young as 2 years old. And the death rates and the injury rates for these children was astronomically high. Workplace injury, adult workplace industry, was extremely high as well. About 1 in 1,000 workers were killed or injured on the job every year. That would be the equivalent in today's terms of over 1.5 million people. And so this was recognized by observers at the time as a crisis. It even had a name. It was called the accident crisis. And so reformers, which included some business leaders, wanted to try to understand what could be done to make the factory, the working place, less dangerous. And what they came to were two ideas. One is that child labor should not exist, that children should be in school, not in factories. And the other was that the United States needed a system of workmen's compensation, similar to what already existed in Germany and the United Kingdom. And a key fact in this story was that workplace injury was much lower in Germany and the United Kingdom. And people concluded it was because workmen's compensation which was a kind of insurance program, actually created a positive incentive for factory owners to clean up their factories to make them safer, because then their insurance premiums would be lower. And so the argument was made that child labor should be greatly limited and that adult labor should be protected by a system of workmen's compensation. Both things that we take for granted today. But this is where we find...
To some extent, we should say, there was a big report today in the New York Times about the comeback of child labor, which I think is tied to, you know, the sort of the empowerment of labor, you know, post COVID, but we'll put that aside for the moment.
No, I know. And I've actually pitched the New York Times a piece on exactly this point, because in fact, we are living with a kind of resurgence of some of these really noxious ideas. But the point is, or at least what we argue in the book, is that we begin to see the beginnings of this argument take place. The argument that the government should not get involved, because this would be denying the freedom of businessmen to run their businesses as they see fit. And so we see the early origins of this story, which then get taken up more vigorously in the 1920s and 30s and carried forward.
And we should say, this is where the Supreme Court came in the concept of the freedom of the contract, which is another way of saying free market, government should not interfere. But the idea that two parties, as long as they agree to do, you know, if the kid goes in and or the parent says my kid can go in on behalf of my kid, then we allow for that. And this is, I mean, you know, and frankly, we have a Supreme Court that is extremely reminiscent of that very court at that time, which I think is no coincidence. And so there's this battle about, the worker safety and child labor. And then we get to, I guess, the National Electric Light Association. As this becomes, as there ends up being a more sort of like, I guess, a consolidation or a cohesion to a programmatic attempt to demonize government, as opposed to like different, you know, industry, you know, captains of industry wanting to just stay out of my business type of thing.
Exactly. And so we discovered this really amazing story about a big propaganda campaign in the 1920s, run by an organization, a trade organization called the National Electric Light Association. So this was a trade organization representing the major electrical utilities in the country, as well as the manufacturers of equipment like Westinghouse and General Electric. The question here was really a question about the failure of capitalism. So the arguments about child labor and workmen's compensation are about the social costs of capitalism, people who get hurt during the operation of factories, and et cetera. But in this case, it was actually about a failure of capitalism itself, the failure of the electricity industry to supply electricity to rural customers. And so a group of reformers led by the Pennsylvania Governor Gifford Pinchot argued that in light of the market failure, in light of the failure of the industry to provide electricity to people who needed it and wanted it in rural areas, the government needed to step in. The response of the electricity industry was to launch a massive propaganda campaign. They were subsequently investigated by the Federal Trade Commission in the 1930s, who called this the largest propaganda, peacetime propaganda campaign in the history of the United States. You know, we're used to government propaganda and wartime propaganda, but this is corporate propaganda during peacetime. And the propaganda campaign was not designed simply to push back against proposals for rural electrification. It was designed to change how Americans thought about capitalism, markets, and government. And so it was a massive campaign, and you know, it's a whole chapter in the book, but just to give you a few highlights, one of the things they did was to hire academics, essentially shills, to present the corporate case and to lie, to misrepresent the facts about the cost of electricity generation. So one of the points that Pinchot made was that in countries where electricity was generated through municipal utilities or through government agencies, as in Canada or parts of Europe, electricity was actually cheaper. But the industry paid academics to say that it wasn't, to write reports, and then they would issue press releases and get the media, which at that time was mostly radio, but also print media, to quote these experts. So it's a kind of Merchants of Doubt story, you know, avant la lettre in the 1930s. And then the other key part, and really the really noxious part, was that then they rewrote textbooks. They took textbooks that actually talked honestly about the market failures, the corruption in the electricity industry, and hired paid academics to rewrite those textbooks, distributed the new textbooks free of charge to libraries across the country, and pressured publishers to adopt the new textbooks and get rid of the old ones.
We should say there are three, basically, I guess, areas in which we see these assaults. And maybe this was the first time that we saw that, but you academia, mass culture, and politics. And these are the three-legged stool, if you will, of the corporate assault on public consciousness. You know, it's always like there's so much convergence around like Austria around that time, like with a guy like Bernays, you know, coming out and, you know, this is a big propagandist. And so much of this seems, I just feel like if it wasn't for Austria, we would have a much better world this day, with all due respect to Austria. There's a lot of
to disassociate myself.
No, I understand. I understand. That's my own little hobby horse. But Austria didn't turn out some great things around that time. I don't know if people remember, but nevertheless, so they set the sort of the template for this like trade or industry, I guess, propaganda push. The next iteration we see on a scale like this comes in the 30s from the National Manufacturers Association. They come out with a thing called, which I thought was fascinating, a tripod of freedoms, which made me immediately think, like, did FDR get his four freedoms as a way of pushing back on this? But it's a question for you, but talk about the tripod of freedoms. And this is also the group that helped promote Reagan later a little bit, didn't it? Okay, but as an actor, I should say, or post actor, but tell us about the NAM, as it were, and their tripod of freedoms.
The National Association of Manufacturers was, in the 1930s, the largest trade organization in the United States, representing manufacturing businesses throughout the country. They were also a really important player in this story. So in the 1930s, they pick up on what NILA has done in the 20s, and they decide essentially to do it again, but to do it better and bigger. And one of the things that they realize, and we have the documents where they say this, so this is NAM officials, NAM staff discussing this problem. The problem is that the ideas that they are promoting are obviously self-serving. They obviously represent the interests of the ruling classes of what then was generally referred to as big business. And in many cases, they're factually incorrect. We know that NILA paid people to lie. So the NAM staff think about this problem. They say, you know, what we need to do is we need to connect this argument to something that Americans love, something that all Americans cherish and care about, so that it will have more resonance with the American people and it won't look like it's just big business supporting its own prerogatives. And the idea they land on is freedom. And I have to say, when we found this, it was pretty chilling because we had written about how the tobacco industry had done the exact same thing in the 1980s and 90s. Here was a trade organization doing this fully 50 years earlier. And so they developed this idea that they called the tripod of freedom. And they launched a massive propaganda campaign in the late 1930s and early 40s based on promoting the idea that American society was founded on three inextricable ideas: representative democracy, so far so good, the civil and political freedoms protected in the Bill of Rights, also good, but the third one, free enterprise. And they claim that because it's a tripod, if you compromise any one of these legs, the tripod will collapse. The whole of American society will collapse. Now, of course, the particular leg that they're trying to promote is the free enterprise leg. And this is interesting in two ways. First of all, they invent the term free enterprise. The historian Larry Glickman has written a great book just on that. Previously, people referred to it as private enterprise. But they say, oh, no, we don't want people thinking this is private. We want people thinking this is free. So they call it free enterprise, and then they create this story about how it's foundation to American culture. But it's not true. Free enterprise appears nowhere in the Declaration of Independence, nowhere in the Constitution. barely discussed, if at all, by founding fathers. And in fact, if you look at the history of the 19th century, you see extensive government involvement in the economy, including protective tariffs that NAM had worked to protect in the 19th century. So the whole story is a fabrication. It's an invention. It's a myth. But it's a way of connecting this story to something that Americans care about, which is freedom.
It is also just a great insight into how you do propaganda,
exactly.
Right? Like you associate your little thing, maybe like, you know, it's only one third of the puzzle there. The other two things are like slam dunk, you know, it's apple pie and mom and also, you know, the majority report. Like those are the three things that people need in their life or something.
Exactly. And it's visual too, right? That you can imagine the tripod, one leg gets undermined and the whole thing falls.
And it's interesting too, because we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, Jefferson Cowie, who wrote a book about freedom and its use within the context of white people's resistance to federal power in the 1800s. And so, like, you know, sort of mutating that, particularly around that time, coming out of the 1920s, there's a lot of like, you know, sort of, that's a very loaded term, the idea of an infringement of freedom in society at that time. And then, you know, like it just made me think of the four freedoms that FDR used to push back on corporate power, being speech again, which is noted, worship, which is, you know, that civil and one of the I guess the legs, and then fear and want, you know, specifically there's an attempt, I think, to reclaim freedom from that initiative. I don't know. That's, I guess, for another person's book. But let's talk about like the deployment of the American Family Robinson. I had never heard of that. It was a radio show. I know what the Swiss Family Robinson is, but this was another tool that they used. And what I think also your book makes clear is that like down the road, when we see the kneecapping of unions, by things like Taft-Hartley, and you understand that like they basically, there was no mechanism to push back on these organized corporate entities anymore, because they inhibited the ability of labor to, which was the only obvious, like sort of like, I guess, bulwark against this, to amass the power or to deploy the power that that corporations were at that time. But I'm
right.
Sorry,
so,
that's a lot.
There's a couple of things there, but I can handle it. So I think a key part of this story is a strong anti-union activity. And so the National Association of Manufacturers and their allies are extremely anti-union. And they try to use the freedom argument against unions to say that unions are an inappropriate infringement on freedom, and that therefore the government should in fact intervene to stop unions. I mean, there's obviously a lot of hypocrisy in this whole story because these folks are perfectly happy to have government when it serves their interest, but fight against government when it doesn't. But to bring back to the American Family Robinson, so as you said, a key part of the argument is that we see this program, and as you said, it is a program, it functions on multiple levels. So one piece is influencing academia and recruiting experts to give the story credibility. A second part is politics, fighting in the political realm. And a third part is mass culture. And in some ways, the mass culture part of the story is the most upsetting because it's the most obviously propagandistic. Well, the academia part is bad too. But
yeah.
I mean, the political part, obviously these people have a right to their views and they have a right to be heard in the political arena. But they also massively propagandize the American people through popular culture. And one important part of the story is a radio program, again, mostly forgotten today, but was very popular at the time called The American Family Robinson. This was a program that was created by the National Association of Manufacturers as part of their propaganda campaign, as part of the Tripod of Freedom campaign. And the idea was to get the message out to millions of Americans in their home where they would listen to this radio program. The program was not identified as being a product of NAM. the listener wouldn't really know where this program had come from, but each week they would hear didactic stories about individual enterprise, the sanctity of the nuclear family, and the importance of keeping the government out of the marketplace. So it was a highly anti-New Deal, anti-FDR, deeply propagandistic radio program. You can find episodes online to listen to, and my students and I did. And this program, we know, was syndicated by over 300 radio stations around the United States. It was supplied by NAM free of charge. So you can imagine if you're a radio station in a small town, you don't have a big budget. And now this radio program, which is well produced and interesting and well written, comes to you free of charge. You say, great, I put this on the air. And you do.
And I want to get to, you know, and break Emma's heart about Little House on the Prairie in a bit. But before we do, let's sort of like as we go through this, this is around the time that Hayek writes Road to Serfdom. And then Mont Pelerin Society, which includes Hayek and von Mises and Milton Friedman and this whole crew that wants to deploy this ideology, essentially, which is, you know, ultimately about really making sure that governments don't have governments work at the service of corporations, essentially. They funk, like, you know, you mentioned hypocrisy in there. And I think from their perspective, it's just like, it's not hypocritical. We want government. Government's okay as long as it services, you know, us on some level or our corporate interests. But do you think Hayek is like creating this ideology as a way of this part of this push to create an academic basis for essentially just corporate interests? Like, I mean, like, you know, that there are examples out there. Surely he must have known about NAM. He must have known about, like, you know, so these corporate interests, you know, and they're worried about socialism and communism coming out of World War II and defeating fascism, and they're looking for an ideological framework in which to fit these corporate interests into.
Yeah, this is a very difficult question, and it's always hard for a historian to answer the question, you know, does someone believe something authentically, or are they doing this because they are being influenced by other people or being paid to do it? And, you know, Eric and I are not Hayek biographers, but I think I'm going to give you a charitable interpretation of both von Hayek and von Mises. So if you were living in Europe in the 1930s, there is this really difficult political situation where on the one hand you have the rise of fascism across much of Europe, but you also have the rise of Soviet-style totalitarianism in Russia and what becomes the East Bloc. And neither of those is very attractive or appealing. So it's a bit of a challenge to think about what you think is the worst threat. And I think that, and it's tricky because, so von Hayek's mentor is Ludwig von Mises, who's considered to be one of the founders of the Austrian School of Economics, which lays the foundation for neoliberalism. Von Mises does work with the Vienna Chamber of Commerce. He's closely connected to Austrian business interests. So in that sense, he's not an independent thinker. But on the other hand, you know, I mean, I have connections to environmental groups. It doesn't mean that I don't believe what I believe.
Right.
So I think that it's fair to assume that both von Mises and von Hayek do hold their views authentically. And it's not crazy. I mean, some of the arguments they make about Soviet centralized planning, it seems to me, are completely legitimate. So a key part of their argument is that if the government plans the economy, well, there's two pieces of it. First of all, it's not going to work because you can never have enough information to plan an economy effectively. Markets are really good at amassing information. You can even think of a marketplace as an information gathering place. And so therefore, centralized planning is probably going to fail because you'll never have enough information quickly enough to make the planning work. I think that's a credible argument. I think it's probably right. But then they go further and they say, but more than that, to plan the economy, the government has to control people. has to control workers. It has to say who gets to work where, how many people will work in the shoe factory, and how many people will work in the munitions factory. And from there, you're on a slippery slope to totalitarianism. Okay, that might even be right too. But then there's the third piece. And the third piece is where it gets ugly. Because then they say, so therefore, in Western democracies, in places like England, for example, if you have a national health service, that's an intervention in the marketplace, and that's going to put you on the road to serfdom. And that's the key move that Hayek makes, that it strikes me as not supported by history and not really logical, because like all slippery slope arguments, it implies that people have no capacity to make judgments. Now, what we do know here, and forgive me for the detail, but it's an important point, I think, to understand how this all operated. We do know that in the 1930s, von Mises was serving as a consultant to the National Association of Manufacturers. And in the 1940s, this coterie of businessmen make the decision to bring those men to America to promote Austrian-style economics in the United States with an American spin. And so even if we grant von Mises and von Hayek 100% integrity, and I think for the sake of argument, it's probably a good idea that we do, but we see the way they get developed, used, exploited, and also dumbed down in America, because that's a key part of the story too, how this rather subtle and nuanced argument is repackaged for an American audience in a much more propagandistic way.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost irrelevant to me. I mean, I suppose from a historical standpoint, it's like, you know, were they sincere or not sincere? It doesn't, that's irrelevant to me. I mean, but I do think that they had a project too, which was like, can we rationalize this impetus into a deployable ideology that can exist and almost sort of like backfill the reason why Anam, for instance, wants these things. And I think that's a sincere endeavor. I mean, on some level, like, you know, like that's, I'm, you know, arguably in the same business. I like my ideology better.
Except that you have fact checkers and you, I hope.
I don't pay academics to lie. I mean,
correct. That's a pretty big difference.
I also go about my business in a different way, but I mean, it's the impetus is the same. I mean, like, you know, how I've got a story, they have a story, they want to deploy it. Theirs also involves, you know, like unethical things, I think, and paying scientists to spread disinformation. But the impetus is the same. Like I have this ideology, and how do we make it is something that is sort of digestible. And so it almost goes from the impetus for places like NAM and this and that, and these nascent sort of like economic ideologies that are developing it, the road to serfdom and Mont Pelerin is really sort of like ways in which to re-export this idea internationally, it seems to me. And it comes back to the States, and we start to see the beginnings of like a programmatic idea of both impacting academia, politics, and popular culture. We're jumping ahead a little bit, but
yeah, this is insane to me. I mean, I grew up reading some of this, right? And I did not realize that Little House on the Prairie, which you spend a good amount of time speaking about, was a part of like a libertarian indoctrination propaganda effort. To talk about that a bit, because I think that might blow some people's minds.
Yes, and one of the things that's so ironic about this whole story is all the while these folks who were writing about art massively criticizing the Soviet Union for propaganda. And particularly, they reserve particular vilification for what they see as the Soviet attempt to propagandize children. And yet, they do the exact same thing. Maybe they recognize it because they know it when they see it. So one of the kind of shocking pieces of this story, and here I want to acknowledge two other scholars whose work we drew on a lot, Caroline Fraser and Christine Woodson. It's the story of the origins of the Little House on the Prairie series. So like millions of other girls, I read those books too growing up, and believed that they were the true life story of Laura Ingalls Wilder, a young girl, teenager growing up on the American frontier. That's how they were marketed by their publisher, and that's what I think most of us thought when we read those books. But it turns out it's not true. And it's not true on a couple of different levels. First of all, Laura Ingalls Wilder didn't write those books. She made rough notes for the books based on actual incidents of her life, but they were crafted into stories by her daughter, Rose Wilder Lane, who was a libertarian thinker, author, and journalist who happened to be friends with Herbert Hoover and was a close correspondent of J. Howard Pugh, the president of Sun Oil Company, and also a major leader in NAM. So there's a direct connection between the Wilders, NAM, and the other business executives that we track in the story. Rose took her mother's notes and crafted them into libertarian parables, emphasizing success through hard work, individual initiative, and no need for help from the government. Well, that was a misrepresentation on at least two levels. It turns out the Ingalls family was not actually successful. Their story of life on the frontier was actually a story of repeated failures, but Rose wiped those away and made it all good, made it all successful through hard work. And the other thing, of course, is that the federal government played a gigantic role in the frontier through the Homestead Act,
right,
through the railroads, and for better or worse, through the removal of indigenous people.
That goes back to the
white settler book that we were speaking about, as well as the American conception of freedom also being tied to freedom for whites as we expel or enslave non-white people as well.
Right. And it's also particularly hypocritical on the issue of property rights, which we just mentioned. Rose Wilder Lane was a huge advocate of property rights, as many libertarians are. And she was a very, very influential libertarian thinker. Again, someone who's been mostly forgotten, but was considered one of the three most influential libertarian thinkers in the mid-century. So in her book, The Discovery of Freedom, which is a nonfiction, well, a book that claims to be nonfiction, although it's filled with falsifications of history, but she makes a very strong point about the centrality of property rights. But of course, underneath all of this is the theft of property from the Native American peoples.
I had a debate with Walter Block. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a big libertarian. He was a Ron Paul advisor and then ultimately became a Trump guy. And he was a professor at, it was like a libertarian sponsored, where?
George Mason,
I think, yeah, or business professor. And I asked him about that. And his answer from a libertarian standpoint, and I'm not being facetious about this, was, well, we start counting when the white people came over from Europe. That's when we start to count property rights, because of course they can't. And it was the French concept of working the land and creating some other value there. And what the indigenous people in this country did is they didn't mar the land enough to establish it as property, I guess, in some way. But
I can just interrupt and say Rose Wilder Lane actually uses that argument, which actually goes back to John Locke, who argued that you make property yours through working on it, which, of course, is a complete effacement of the work that indigenous people, in fact, did do on their lands in many different ways. But Rose Wilder Lane explicitly uses that, like you say, to kind of reset the clock so that all the stuff that happened before Europeans came, somehow that gets effaced or expunged from history.
That is the amazing thing about libertarianism. It is supposed to be like an eternal sort of ideology that exists in nature, but we decide when that starts. And it just coincidentally starts when we get onto this country, just by coincidence. We should say there was like a tax. There was a real concerted effort. I mean, of no more grapes of wrath. These stories can't be told because of the way that they sort of like, portray government's relationship to people and corporations' relationships to people. Tell us a little bit about Norman Vincent Peale, because this is really fascinating. I mean, I grew up with Reagan and to some extent Carter and Clinton. So I'm, that's a less of a surprise. We can see, they're almost coasting. Well, Reagan's not so much. But certainly Clinton's coasting on a lot of this stuff. But talk about Norman Vincent Peale, because this is all of this is so important to the way that we interpret information today, I think.
Yes. So one of the things that made this book hard to write is we kept finding more material, more connections, more things that were relevant to the story, which is why, you know, in the end, we ended up with a rather big book. And we like to say it took a big book to describe the big myth. So as I mentioned before, one of the problems that these propagandists had was that their account of history was false. Their account of electricity markets was false. The stories that Rose Wilder Lane told about her mother were false. So they're constantly grappling with having to brush aside the truths of history, the truths of people's lives. But there was another problem that they encountered that was different and in some ways maybe even more profound. And it had to do with our understanding of Christianity. So in the 1920s, 30s, and into the 40s, many American Protestants felt that capitalism was not really compatible with being a true Christian. Jesus, after all, had preached a message of love for the poor. Famously, in the old, in the New Testament, it says that a rich man can go to heaven as easily as a camel can go through the eye of a needle. So there's this really strong message in Jesus's teachings that could be viewed even as socialistic. And this is a big, big problem for the captains of American industry, and they know it, and it troubles them. And so they decide that they need to do something about it. And the something they need to do is to realign American Protestants with free market economics and to persuade them that that interpretation of Christianity that I've just been describing is wrong, that actually it's fully Christian to believe in a free market economy that doesn't protect workers or children and in which individuals can amass massive amounts of wealth. And so they do this with yet another project. The project is called Spiritual Mobilization, and it's heavily funded by J. Howard Pugh, the president of Sun Oil Company, who I just mentioned was also a correspondent of Rose Wilder Lane. They fund a minister by the name of James Fifield or Fifield, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, so a viewer can call in if they know. And he begins to do a number of things. They create a journal called Christian Economics. I'm not making that up. They have newsletters that they send out to ministers across the country, beginning to preach a kind of gospel of wealth, drawing on this idea that people who are wealthy are good people, and that's why God is rewarding them with so much wealth. Trying to influence the curricula in seminaries, and ultimately also supporting a number of charismatic preachers who they believe can be effective in bringing this message. One of those preachers is Norman Vincent Peale, who writes the best-selling book, The Power of Positive Thinking, which, you know, again, not entirely wrong. I think most of us will agree positive thinking does have power, but it's focusing on this idea of individualism, that you can succeed through dint of your own attitude and you don't need the government to help you. Now, two of Peale's parishioners, Mary and Fred Trump, and in later years, Peale...
I got to tell you, like the entire time you've been talking about this, I've been holding back my just raging desire to just do a Trump impersonation going, it's true. Everything he's saying is true.
Thank you.
I mean, honestly, like it is, if you want to understand why Donald Trump standing on that stage in 2016 was completely bulletproof from anything anybody said up there. And you can see this in George W. Bush was like the CEO president, but Donald Trump was really the culmination of that, of that impetus. Like, you know, Paul Ryan talking about sort of like how, you know, this concept of like being, you know, morally righteous. If you're poor, you sort of like morally, you've lost some righteousness. Donald Trump standing on that stage, there was nothing that he couldn't say that wasn't morally more righteous and correct, because he was the richest guy there, and that's right. It. And was not, and knew enough to deploy that in a way that we've seen like Republican candidates in the past sort of like hold back a little bit. Like I think Forbes Rand at one point, the guy with the flat tax, he didn't get out in front because he was ashamed of his money a little bit. He had that old money quality, but Trump, he just realized like, this is what we've been building towards where, you know, I'm the king because God said so.
I know. And the thing is, we didn't set out to write a book about Donald Trump. In fact, the idea for this book predates Donald Trump running for public office. So it was pretty staggering to us when we found these connections, direct connections to the Trump family, to show and to see, as you just said, the ways in which the foundations for this approach have been laid for a long time and have come to fruition in sometimes really, really frightening ways.
Very frightening ways. Well, I guess we can just briefly, as we get into Carter and Reagan and Clinton, I mean, Clinton famously said, you know, like the era of big government is over. Reagan obviously said like the most terrifying words that you can hear are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, or something to that effect. Carter also like made this big push for deregulation. This by the time we get to the 70s, these guys have won on an intellectual level, haven't they?
Yeah, I think so. And that's really what the third is about, is how these ideas, which were not mainstream through the 1940s, 50s, 60s, how they were mostly rejected by most Americans. Public opinion polls showed vast majority of Americans supported Social Security, Medicare, wanted the government to protect the environment. But these ideas begin to become mainstream. And so the third of the book looks at how that happens. And a key figure, of course, is Ronald Reagan. And so one of the things we do in the book is to explain better where Reagan came from. Because I remember when Ronald Reagan was elected, and there was a feeling as if it seemed like he kind of came out of the blue. Like, how did this actor who had been a Democrat and a union president suddenly reappear as a politician who was anti-union, anti-government Republican? So in the book, we answer that question. And we show that Reagan's transition took place when he worked for the General Electric Corporation in the late 1950s and became a spokesperson for GE's deeply anti-government, deeply anti-union ideology.
And then he went around on tours, and he was talking about actually like even universal health care he expanded into, and then he ran for governor in California and off to the races, as it were.
And GE gives him both a political platform. They give him a media platform because he hosts their television series, General Electric Theater. So he becomes one of the most well-known people in the United States. And he's able to use that then to segue into political life. And he also gets a set of powerful, rich backers who finance his transition into politics, first in his run for governor of California, and then
later. Can't believe someone used a platform of television to launch a political career.
Did it first.
So with all this said, and certainly like we can, what's amazing is you have 100 years of this history, more of this history of like a concerted effort to attack government. Yet 2 weeks ago, Joe Biden made the Republican Party basically pledge on national television that we're not going to touch Social Security and Medicare, which is, you know, there are two major functions of the U.S. government. That is to make, arms sales manufacturers really wealthy, and to provide social insurance in the form of Medicare and Social Security. Just in a dollar basis, those are the two major functions of our government. And despite this concerted effort, they have not been able to touch Social Security and Medicare. They've done a job on, they've made some inroads in Medicare, but it's been very subtle in terms of like privatizing parts of it. What is the solution to this in this day and age? Because corporate America is always going to have more money to buy academia. And it feels like that dynamic has accelerated or become more pronounced as the nature of academia has changed, where there's sort of this arms race to who can have the nicest humanities building, and we're going to need capital for that.
No, it's not the nicest humanities building.
Whatever it is.
Nice economics building.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yes, my apologies. But that dynamic has increased. We still have obviously corporate control of all of our media. And including the news, to the extent that the news has become more captured by corporate interests, I would say more so than even back then, to some extent. What is the, how does one propagandize against this? I mean, I have no problem using propaganda as a value neutral term, but how does one do that in this context? I know this is a little bit outside your portfolio, but you've spent a lot of time seeing how the bad guys did it. What do you see is the solution or a potential solution?
Well, I'm going to depart from you on using the word propagandize, because I am going to say we don't have to propagandize, because actually the truth is on our side. Because one of the empowering things about this story is you see how much these people lied, misrepresented, cherry-picked. And in that sense, this book has a very close family resemblance with our previous work in Merchants of Doubt. It's really a book about disinformation and how people get disinformation to take hold. And so one lesson of this story is you don't have to lie when the facts are on your side. You don't have to resort to propaganda, but you do have to have a good story. You do have to have a good narrative. And I think one of the things we see in this book is how these people worked so hard to tell a story that was compelling, and to tell it on television and radio and film and in children's book and in academia. And so I think that progressives need to rethink, what is our story and how do we get that story across? And, you know, this is a complicated problem, and there isn't going to be like, I'm not going to be able to wave my magic wand and fix it. But I think one important thing does have to do with how we think of ourselves and our relationship to our government. And I'm going to emphasize our, because I think one of the things that's been lost in this propaganda, one of the ways in which they have succeeded is, you know, the use of the term the government, or the use of the term big government, right? These were part of the propaganda stories. Big government was deliberately introduced to be a contrast with big business, and to shift the way people thought from hating big business, which most people in the 1920s did, to hating big government. So I think we have to reject that language, and we have to remember, you know, what the founding fathers said, despite their flaws. Government is an expression of the will of the people. That's what democratic governance is all about. And so I think we need to reclaim that notion. And that means reclaiming our own identity as citizens. Back in the 1920s and 30s, lots of Americans thought of themselves as workers. Then they came to see themselves as consumers. Mm. And of course, we are those things. And we sometimes have power as workers and consumers. But our greatest power, I think, is as citizens, because we are all citizens. But a lot of us have kind of abandoned that. I was thinking the other day about my own parents. I grew up in New York City, where we used to say it was a two-party system, the regular Democrats and the reform Democrats. And my parents were reform Democrats, and they belonged to a political club. And it met every Saturday. And when it was time to get out the vote, my parents would be on the phone. They would get calls from people about where things were happening. And they had a really strong sense of civic engagement. I don't know anyone today who's a member of a political club. Not a single person. So I don't know if that's the right model or we need some new model. But I think all of us need to be engaged. And we can't just think of as the government as something that's out there that we're not connected to. We need to reclaim those connections and think about where is the place that we can make a difference in our own lives. And that will be different for different people, but that's at least one piece of the story, I think.
We can, I think we'll be able to send you information on the Boston DSA up there if you are interested in joining a club. I mean, and to a large extent, that is like, you know, we're seeing, you know, it's, I mean, it's happening with, I think, like, there is a generational divide, I think, that, like, you know, And maybe it has to do with when the fall of the Soviet Union happened or what, or, you know, post-Occupy. But there is there does seem to be a change. And we're seeing it reflected to some extent in the administration, right? I mean, we have gone from a consumer-oriented FTC and Department of Justice antitrust division to a more citizen model that is looking at the implications of this anti-competitiveness in terms of what it does to our politics and to what it does to sort of like broad-based opportunity for people. And we're seeing, I think, you know, at least to some extent in some places in this administration, a reinvigorated sense of labor, although, you know, not to the extent that I think is optimal, but certainly relative to the last Democratic administrations we've seen, there has been a change.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the other important thing is we need to tell the stories of government success stories, because we've been so bombarded with this idea that, you know, big government doesn't work, that it's wasteful, that it's corrupt, that many of us are not really, you know, we don't have the stories of government success at our fingertips. So in the book, we have a whole section where we talk about that. And I'll just give one example. I did a book reading last week in Washington, D.C., and it was a very friendly audience, but a person in the audience who was clearly friendly, not hostile, but he said, well, how can we defend government when so many government programs are failures? And I said, well, actually, a lot of government programs are successes. I mean, think about the interstate highway system, Social Security, Medicare, the space exploration, the internet, right? These were all government programs and they're success stories. And I think one of the reasons why the Republicans keep going after Social Security, because they do, they went after it under Reagan, they went after it under George W. Bush, and they're going after it again, as Joe Biden correctly pointed out. Why do they keep going after Social Security when the American people love Social Security? Polls show that something like 70 to 80% of us approve of Social Security and do not want to see it privatized or reduced or cut. Well, I think the answer is they go after it because it works, because it's successful, because it refutes their core ideology about the failures of big government. Social Security, as you pointed out, it's giant government. It's a big government program and it really works. It has achieved what it was set out to achieve. It has protected elderly Americans from poverty. And so it shows that actually big government can work. And that's why Republicans have to fight it.
Naomi Orsak, the book is The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market, which you co-authored, as you know, with Eric Conway. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being
with
you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Emma.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and head into the so-called fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls and your IMs and do some videos. We went a little bit long in that, but
yeah, well, it was worth it.
It's a great interview.
That book is just like pulls it all together, right?
I remember listening to Merchants of Doubt like when I first moved here.
Yeah,
audiobook. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I want to see the documentary version too. Is that good?
I haven't seen the documentary.
But yeah, yeah.
I mean, folks, I hate to, you know, pat myself on the shoulder. And since none of you read FUBAR, and I say that with 100% assuredness.
Yes.
Stephen Sherrill and I, who I actually just saw the other day, wrote about market fundamentalists and religious fundamentalists being the Republican Party.
Mm.
And also some self-hating closeted gay people, which
you
know, is also you know, still maintained its salience. We also wrote about Thomas Friedman, and he's not as relevant anymore. But
it's the last thing he did.
The last big push he did was MBS is a good
MBS,
guy.
MBS, yeah.
Yeah. He's had to lay low, I think, since then. He had to retire his rickshaw metaphors or whatever it was. I spoke to a rickshaw driver, and he gave me a great idea about the, that explains the entire world.
I was at an up-class sandwich shop with my taxi driver for some reason, and he didn't know how to order.
Like, oh, my God, I forgot about that. What was it, prosciutto?
Oh,
or?
My God. Don't even get me started.
Jesus Christ.
Folks. We should put that on the best of list. I feel like,
there's
honestly, like we already have five best of, and it's not even, we're not even in March yet.
I know. And I really loved the interview I did on Palo Alto last Wednesday, too.
We may have to take an extra vacation.
Oh, boy.
An extra week of vacation just to get all the best ofs in.
I mean, we're not complaining.
folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You know, I was talking to this has always been a problem with this show. We put out too much show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody knows it. Everybody knows that we put out too much show. If we did one interview a week like this, we'd have, like, you know, we'd probably get more numbers than we get on a weekly basis, even. But this is the, you know, I don't know. This is what we started, and we've known this for a long time.
But also, nobody else can do this either.
Nobody else can do it. Has to be done. But it is your support that makes this show possible. You can help the show survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free half free of commercials, you get the fun half too. And we've got, oh yeah, you get the I Am the Show via the app and other stuff. There's got to be other stuff.
So much other stuff.
Including always
great
in the
merch.
Works. Great merch.
Oh, I had a merch idea the other day.
You did?
Yeah, I meant to text you, but I didn't want to bother you.
All right. Well, yeah. I appreciate that. We can talk about that later.
Yeah.
Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Support our sponsors. They make the show possible too, particularly those guys over at Just Coffee and Sunset Luxury. Mm-hmm.
And a stocking cap from those guys. I'm excited about this. I needed a stocking cap. So.
Oh yeah, they got nice merch there too. Emma, I still have people talking to me about the cheese.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah well, I mean, I'm making headlines with that. Today, Matt Leck coming on.
Oh yeah.
Filling in for Bradley. And we're just going to have some fun and talk about the NBA, maybe some Karl Malone. I also have some...
Karl Malone?
Yeah.
Karl Malone was invited back. The All-Star game was in Utah. And I don't know if you're familiar with the whole Karl Malone thing, are you?
I remember him from like 30 years ago.
He got a child pregnant at age 12.
Yeah, there's some submerged Karl Malone
stuff. What?
And it was kind of known, but like... not really talked about this entire time in the NBA, but now the internet exists and people talk about the fact that he had a child with a 12-year-old.
What?
When he was like in college.
Yes.
And
denied it vociferously. That child ended up being an NFL offensive lineman. Then he finally acknowledged the child. He's a terrible person. NRA donor, Bush donor in his 2004 reelection bid.
I was never a fan of his.
They were a match made in heaven, him and John Stockton, because John Stockton is a big time anti-vax lunatic now.
I had no idea.
So,
no,
you know, we all owe Michael Jordan and the Bulls a lot of thanks, because if he didn't come around to steal that ball from Karl Malone on the lower block and then hit that crossover on Byron Russell and win that, we would have NBA champion John Stockton and Karl Malone and probably. I don't know.
But was that the same year they beat the Knicks in the finals?
All right, guys. I see you talking about Karl Malone. I had no idea.
No, we'll talk about it then. I mean, I don't really have a run. We'll figure it out. We're going to talk NBA, but I have some bones to pick with the NHL as well.
NBA like highlights.
Yeah, and we're just going to have some fun. So 4 p.m. today, Matt Leck joining us as a guest on ESPN.
It's huge. Huge crossover episode.
It'll be really fun. And for Left Reckoning, Matt.
Speaking of Matt Leck Media.
Yeah, yesterday we had a talk with Luke Savage, David and I, talking about the Trump and DeSantis thing, including like what's going to happen when Trump realizes that nobody cares about whether he won the election or not. They kind of want to know, like, you know, what's this going to
be. You don't
care.
Me?
Yeah, everybody really cares, and everyone wants to look backwards forever at that loss until it's rectified. But including like him hitting DeSantis on he wants to cut your Social Security, which I'm very here for, because Trump, I think, will increasingly go to those sorts of things.
Rona McDaniel said that you got to take a loyalty pledge to participate in the debates, and that's going to be interesting. Right. Well, first off, Trump's going to be like, okay, yeah, I'll be loyal. Oh, and you didn't hear the other part where I said, I'll be loyal if I think things are on the up and up.
Yeah, unless something happens.
And I'm not sure things are on the up and up, but it's also like, you don't want me at the debate? guess who's not going to watch the debate? Nobody. If I'm not on the debate, nobody's going to watch. I'll tell you what, I'll have a debate and I'll invite people. Maybe we'll just sponsor a Trump Mar-a-Lago debate.
Yeah.
Instead of a Republican debate.
I got to make sure that it's loyal to me. So I'll sign this pledge. But if it's not loyal to me, we might have to reconsider.
Did you say loyal me? All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. I really did hold back. I tried to, like, I was just going to interrupt her about five times during the
sorry.
Guest.
Sorry.
What? So that's
yeah. What? Wait.
That sounds smart.
It's Christian to make money. What are you talking about?
I'm the best Christian. 2 Corinthians.
646-257-3920. I'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money.
A hell of a lot of bank.
A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on.
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.